Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Additional equipment to the tops of Jefferson, 1235 Jefferson, between Riley and Laurel, for an active shooter mass casualty incident.
There are three bodies outside.
You know, also, we're going to need some officers inside the tops because we have numerous bodies and we have magazines and bullets and everything. So we need evidence secure.
Something happened to Buffalo's East Side 4 years ago that the community could have never prepared for. Days after May 14th, 2022, thousands of people flocked to a side of town that most would go out of their way to avoid. The streets were lined with caution tape, news cameras, makeshift memorials, food distribution sites. The eyes of the world were on a neighborhood that its own city had ignored for decades. Then, something else happened that the community could have never prepared for. Donations started pouring in by the hundreds, thousands, millions. Promises to help the victims and survivors, support for community-based organizations, declarations of long-term investment. It was money offered in the language of healing. It wasn't just emergency response. No, it was community revival. Well, it could have been. It was supposed to be. Those who are among the most impacted say that things have changed. Unfortunately, not for the better.
I just feel like we are in a worse spot than we were because it's so hurtful that this money did come in and it didn't make it to where it was supposed to go.
Over here, it looks, yeah.
The same, if not worse.
It looks worse. 100% worse, actually.
It's worse. It's worse.
4 years and nearly $100 million later, questions remain about not only how much money was raised, but what actually changed because of it. For months, I've been searching for answers from donors and recipients of 514 funds. I've tracked dozens of donations, pledges, and allocations. Every answer I got led me back to one question. A question that rings through the East Side of Buffalo today. Where did the money go? I'm Ijaz Jasil, and this is What's Next.
Really was still angering me and keeping me full of anxiety and search for restitution for this community. What happened to all of that money?
First things first, where did the money actually come from? To start, let me clarify. The dollars and cents that I'll be discussing are from sources of money that I could independently identify and verify. This is by no means a comprehensive account of every dollar that came from every person and entity. That would be nearly impossible to account for. These are major gifts and pledges of $10,000 or more that came from notable sources. And while there's not enough time nor space to name them all here, you can find them on our web story at btpm.org. So, let's get into it. I've identified more than $90 million in individual donations, pledges, and allocations from numerous sources, all related to 514. Three quarters of this funding came from New York State, with lion's share being a substantial investment that Governor Kathy Hochul made to Buffalo's East Side 1 month and 4 days after the mass shooting, a devotion to initiatives like securing and growing Black homeownership, growing businesses and increasing food access, all on Buffalo's East Side.
Let's go big. Let's be bold. We've identified an additional
$50 million of resources for the east side of Buffalo. This is a long-standing personal commitment from the governor of New York State to this community.
Nearly $3 million in funding were administered by the New York State Office of Victim Services. One survivor says she only got $250. You'll hear her story later. Just this February, Attorney General Letitia James announced an award for injured and impacted individuals by way of a settlement with a gun accessory manufacturer for its role in helping the shooter possess an assault weapon in violation of New York State's SAFE Act.
Mean Arms will pay $1.75 million to the families of those killed, to bystanders, and those who were injured.
In addition to state funding, there were also contributions from higher and lower levels of government. At the federal level, over $12 million were allocated, the vast majority devoted to expanding access to mental health resources in the East Side community. But the federal money funded other things as well, like increased police patrols at large-scale events to protect against terroristic threats and gun violence, and assistance to help offset overtime and fringe benefits costs associated with law enforcement response to the mass shooting. As for contributions from the City of Buffalo and Erie County, both shelled out funds, but only for the development of the 514 Memorial and Healing Center. The county provided $500,000, while the city pledged $1 million. While we're on the topic of government funds, both federal and state support helped found two community-based response sites connected by one common thread, a word that cycles through press conferences and news reports every year. Resilience. The Community Health Center of Buffalo Resiliency Center and the Buffalo United Resiliency Center are two similarly named institutions created to provide trauma response and support services to people impacted by 514. Both have changed over the years, but today, they can each be traced back to the Community Health Center of Buffalo, or CHCB. The Buffalo United Resiliency Center was established with state funding and is listed as a Buffalo Urban League program. In 2023, Governor Kathy Hochul designated the Buffalo Urban League to lead a partnership with the CHCB to operate the center. But its funding timeline, location history, and relationship to the health center's federally funded resiliency work remain murky. State records show a $5 million Office of Victim Services contract with the Buffalo Urban League, while public announcements describe $2.5 million in state support through June 2025 and nearly $3.9 million in federal funding awarded to CHCB and Best Self. I couldn't get in contact with Thomas Buford Jr., CEO of the Buffalo Urban League, to learn more about his organization's involvement, but I did speak with the CHCB's Chief Operating Officer, Al Hammonds. We discussed the differences between the two resiliency centers, the government funding that was allocated for both, and what role they've played in post-514 recovery. So the first thing that I want to ask is about the Buffalo United Resiliency Center. I think sometimes the wires get crossed because there are technically like two resiliency centers. There's Buffalo United Resiliency Center and the Community Health Center of Buffalo Resiliency Center. But I understand the CHCB kind of oversees both now. Can you sort of break down the difference to me?
Yeah, so what we have is a specific grant and responsibilities under the Office of Victim Services. So we have federal government oversight from the Department of Justice, and this is an anti-terrorism an emergency assistance program for the crime victims that were part of 514, for the crime victims, and to help give them compensation and or assistance working through that trauma. Our role is to serve the victims and not necessarily do community programming. This, what we're doing is the grant money that we received and what the Department of Justice has been very clear with us on is they do not want what we're doing with these funds to be used for community-based events. That's not what they want and not what they charged us to do. It's to support the necessary and ongoing trauma-informed, evidence-based healing that's needed for these victims and the victim's family, which also includes law enforcement. It's also really focused on mental health related services to the victims and their families, and get them the mental health and wellness training they need for both the first responders and the families. Does that help?
Yeah, that's very helpful. I actually did not know that you were meant to assist the first responders as well.
Yes, yes.
Okay. And can you give me some specifics into exactly what types of services you provide?
Well, what we're doing, we're kind of in an oversight role. We were basically funded to put together an infrastructure to build and create a resiliency center and put that infrastructure in place, like stuff like have a place, office space, furniture, stand up staffing that's dedicated to this, programmatic supplies, things of that nature. We also are responsible for selecting contracted agencies to support the victims. And the subcontracted agencies oversee several services for the victims, including training for the providers, whether it be clinical or behavioral health, first responders. A lot of times we brought in first responders from out of the area to help train and help support the first responders and the victims, and for the and to help make sure we have resiliency center staff on hand to be able to provide short-term victim emergency assistance. A lot of that happened in the first year or so of the grant. So, you know, like what happened is the focus of this grant is to serve the three injured victims and the 94 individuals who were inside of the store. And then other folks that may have been affected only within a one block radius of the shooting. So this isn't widespread community-based support. It's very targeted. It's very specific. The funds are, I want you to make sure you note that the funds are restrictive. We're very restricted. For the funds that we received, we were awarded just over $3.889 million. Mm-hmm. We didn't get that money. It's a model where we perform the services and we spend the money first. It's a reimbursement model. So then we have to submit documentation and compliance documents, narratives, everything, and get approved, and then we are funded from that $3.8 million to reimburse us.
Okay, so just a couple of follow-up questions on a couple of things you told me. First, I wanted to know how much of this funding is required to actually give to the victims in terms of some of that financial help that you say you provide, and are there any deliverables as to how much money has actually been given to victim survivors?
We don't really give money directly to the victims. So the victims have to basically show documentation and proof that they need help with receipts, or they need help with counseling or with recovering from their trauma. And then we fund those services and needs of the victims. That's what we pay for. We don't really give the money directly to the victims.
Okay. And as a part of that, just to make sure I don't misunderstand, but I believe I recall reading that the Resiliency Center was also meant to help if someone had fallen short on, like, rent or bills. Was that something else that you all helped to do?
Early on, yes. Not now, but early on, I would say, so this event happened, you know, in 2022. So in the first, I'd say 6 months to a year, you know, maybe 18 months at the most, if families were in desire need, were in need, and they qualify because family members or folks associated with their family were actually at the top storm when it happened, or they live within the one block radius, then we would help, possibly with rent or some expenses, medical expenses or something like that. But if they were outside of that one block radius, even if they were struggling, we couldn't fund it.
Right, because it was meant for the immediate community, I understand.
Right, exactly.
Later in the series, you'll be hearing more about the Resiliency Center, both from Hammonds and from people who sought services there. There will also be answers to account for the $3.8 million grant that the Department of Justice awarded to the Community Health Center of Buffalo to operate the Resiliency Center. But for now, back to those donations. Now that we've covered major government contributions, let's take a look at corporate donors. It only makes sense to start with Tops Supermarket. The grocer planted $500,000 in seed money to establish the Buffalo 514 Survivors Fund in partnership with the National Compassion Fund. Wegmans, normally a competitor to Tops, became an ally in the wake of the tragedy, putting forth $400,000 in contributions to both the 514 Survivors Fund as well as the second major resource pool that emerged afterward, the Buffalo Together Community Response Fund. Nearly every major bank in the region gave six-figure donations to various organizations and causes to support both immediate and long-term investment in Buffalo's East Side. The KeyBank Foundation gave one of the largest contributions of $250,000, plus over $31,000 matched in employee contributions. Publicly, the foundation's gift was said to go toward supporting the victims' families. I reached out to a KeyBank representative who shared that the funds were dispersed among 11 local organizations. When I asked how much money was allocated to each of those organizations, they declined to give me a breakdown. HSBC Bank was more transparent, but their documentation didn't align with what was publicly reported. 2 days after the mass shooting, the bank's CEO, Michael Roberts, released an official statement saying that the bank would be donating $100,000 to provide immediate fresh food, groceries, and other much-needed supplies to the community. When I reached out to HSBC to confirm their donation, a representative sent me a statement provided by their recipient, Feed More Western New York. The nonprofit stated that they were able to distribute approximately 251 tons of food and increase the presence of its mobile food pantry in and around Buffalo, thanks to the bank's generous grant of $75,000? That's $25,000 less than what HSBC had said it would give. The bank's representative told me in an email that, quote, "The impact is what is most important to us over the donation amount," end quote. But that raises a critical question. If the impact truly matters, how should the public measure it? Because in this case, the bank publicly announced one number, but the records provided to confirm that donation showed another. While some donors appeared to give less than what they had promised, some actually gave a bit more. At least in one case, I can confirm. I reached out to Delaware North, a giant in the hospitality and entertainment industry, to learn more about their gift of $250,000 for recovery efforts. The company said in a statement 3 days after the massacre that they were working with community and business leaders to understand where the funds would have the most impact. They contributed to a dozen organizations and initiatives, mostly Black-led and/or youth development-centered. A third of Delaware North's total contribution, which was over $2,000 more than was publicly reported, went to the Boys and Girls Club feeding program. The United Way of Buffalo and Erie County also detailed how they spent their $100,000 food grant provided by General Mills. They administered those funds to four organizations to help launch a farmers market on the East Side, distribute produce vouchers, supply non-perishables to pantries, and support existing food and security programs. The United Way also played another critical role in the wake of the tragedy, serving as the collection point for one of those two major funds I mentioned a bit earlier, which is resurfacing in headlines these days for a number of reasons. Buffalo Together, as it's now called, raised $6.3 million. But for what and for whom exactly? Was this a fund to provide direct relief to victims and survivors, or was it created to serve another purpose? To help answer some of those questions, I sat down with Garnell Whitfield Jr., a member of the Buffalo Together Steering Committee and the son of Ruth Whitfield, one of 10 lives lost in the act of domestic terrorism. Here's what he shared about the fund-turned-nonprofit organization.
I just want to first get a little bit of background for some people who may be unfamiliar with exactly what the Buffalo Together Fund is. Can we sort of talk about its formation and what these funds specifically, what purpose they were meant to serve?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fund that was established right after 514. There were 14 original funders, a community foundation in the United Way, Buffalo and Erie County were principally a part of that original funding group. Then donations came in from around the country, actually, or globally, to contribute to that. And the fund was set up to address the systemic issues that have long plagued the east side of Buffalo. So it's a fund designed to address long-standing issues within the east side of Buffalo.
Okay, and understand a part of addressing issues was supporting organizations that specifically help the east side community, correct?
Right, yes. Yes, we wanted to immediately provide some funding to first, you know, right after 514, two organizations that were doing the work, boots on the ground organizations within the east side of Buffalo to help sustain their efforts in the immediate aftermath of 514. And then some more funding did come out later on to continue that support.
Okay, and the fund is led by a steering committee. Two questions on that, because I understand you're part of the steering committee. Have you been since its inception, and also is the steering committee advisory or decision making for these funds?
Okay, so the steering committee is decision making for these funds. I wasn't a part of the original formation of the Buffalo Together Community Response Fund, but was invited to be a part of that once it was established.
Okay. And about when was that you joined the steering committee? Was it 2023 or?
Well, it feels like I've been there since its inception because I was invited early on. I don't have a date specific to that, but it was early on, right after it was formed.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I saw that there is a search for an executive director. Does the Buffalo Together Fund have an executive director yet, or are you still in search?
We don't have an executive director. We are currently in the process of recruiting an executive director to lead this effort. Yes.
Okay, gotcha. So I wanted to ask about the funds that were raised through Buffalo Together. I saw on the website that there was $6.3 million raised, and there was $655,000 in emergency grants given to 86 different organizations. So the website says that there's a remaining $6.1 million in pledges and contributions for a long-term strategy, but when you take $655,000 from $6.3 million, that's $5.64 million about. So it's a little less than 6.1. Do you know where that discrepancy came from? Is it in hand cash versus pledges?
No. So it's not a discrepancy. What it is that so there were two grant rounds that were distributed, a total of $1.3 million. But having that money in an interest bearing account has made up for that deficit. So that's why we still have $6.1 million currently.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Mm-hmm. And as was mentioned, funds, grants did go to 86 different organizations. Can you tell me about the selection process of those organizations? How do you determine who get the money?
Well, we wanted to get money into the hands of organizations and people in our community that were doing the work. Many of them were doing the work before 514, and they geared up, and some of them pivoted in the immediate aftermath of 514. And these are organizations that traditionally within our community are Black-led organizations who don't have administrative help, who don't meet a lot of qualifications for grant funding and those kinds of things like that, who needed our support. They were addressing the immediate needs of the community, and we wanted to support that. And so that's how that money was distributed.
And what do you say to someone who may sort of question the intent of giving grants to 86 different organizations? Some might think that to disperse money amongst that many different organizations would kind of break up the ability to help the community most effectively, that there may have been too wide a disbursement. Do you think that was a good move to give money to that many organizations, or should have been a more focused effort?
No, it was a focused effort. It was focused on the east side of Buffalo. And these are groups and entities that were doing the work, who have been doing the work without any fanfare, without any support in many cases. And those are the persons who we wanted to make sure that we supported.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And I did notice there were a couple of folks who serve on the steering committee. I don't know if they still do, but as of the last time I checked, which was this morning, a few folks on the steering committee. One was from Housing Opportunities Made Equal, someone from Buffalo Urban League. A few of these individuals head or are part of organizations that receive some of the Buffalo Together grant funding. Do you think this is a conflict of interest?
No, because, you know, these organizations, again, these were not allocations to individuals, but to organizations that are doing work within our community. These are longstanding organizations who have done great work over the years in our community, and they also needed support. And so, you know, if that is the case that they did receive some funding, it was not to them or to their organization, it was for the people that they serve.
Okay, so there's no concern that someone serving on the steering committee may have had some sort of influence in, you know?
Everyone on the steering committee are leaders within our community and have day jobs. And in many cases are CEOs or lead different organizations within our community. And so their work was an integral part of you know, supporting the east side of Buffalo before 514 and continues to be after the fact.
Okay. And were any of the funds raised, did all of those funds go into the long-term investment project and giving grants to the organizations, or were some funds used for staffing or other purposes?
Yeah. So none of the funds have been used for staffing. The Community Foundation has been supportive of the Buffalo Together Fund in terms of providing in-kind services, staffing, and those sorts of things like that. The Community Foundation raised and provided the money to do to, you know, to employ the entity, the national advisory or consultancy group that helped us develop the planning and everything else. So none of the money that was raised for this project was used in those efforts.
Before we move on, one point of clarification. At the end of our interview, Mr. Whitfield told me that the Buffalo Together Steering Committee was formed after the first round of grants had already been distributed. As a result, he said no current steering committee member participated in allocating funds to their own organization or personal endeavors, and therefore did not view it as a conflict of interest. So far, we've looked at major contributions from government at the city, county, state, and federal levels, along with large gifts from corporate donors. There are a couple more categories I looked at. The third, sports teams. Seeing how Buffalo is such a sports city, whether people are rooting for the Bills, the Sabres, the Bandits, or the Bisons, it would only make sense for these teams to show their loyalty to the Buffalo community the same way Buffalonians turn out and tune in for their big games, right? Especially during such a critical time. You've likely seen the photos of players, staff, and coaches from Buffalo's professional sports teams either visiting the memorial or helping distribute food on Jefferson Avenue. But beyond the tributes and volunteerism, what tangible support was actually provided? The largest contribution appears to be a joint effort from the Bills, the Sabres, and the Bandits through the sales of their branded Choose Love t-shirts, which reportedly raised over $1 million in proceeds that went to the Buffalo 514 Survivors Fund and Buffalo Together. Individually, the Buffalo Bills put up $200,000, doubled through a matching contribution from the NFL Foundation. That money also contributed to Buffalo Together and four nonprofits focused on improving food distribution and access. Former Bills running back Thurman Thomas and his wife Patricia helped raise over $264,000 through the Thurman Thomas Family Foundation. Those funds were said to have gone to families of the victims and the community, as reported by ESPN. I can confirm that three gifts of $50,000 were donated to the 514 Survivors Fund by way of GoFundMe. Another gift from the football world. In response to the mass shooting, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and his wife Jane donated $50,000 to the Bills Social Justice Fund. But because the fund predates 514 and distributes grants to nonprofits annually, it's unclear whether any of that money directly reached victims' families, survivors, or the impacted community. The Sabres donated $100,000 to the Resource Council of Western New York, which served as an early hub for 514 relief and the original organization selected to operate the federally funded Buffalo United Resiliency Center. The Bandits auctioned off used game equipment and autographed balls, raising over $6,000, while forward Dane Smith announced that he raised over $15,000. Both the auction proceeds and Smith's contributions were said to be for the families of victims. It's unclear whether the funds were forwarded to the 514 Survivors Fund or if the money got to the families by some other means. I initially had the Buffalo Bisons down for a $10,000 donation to the Willie Hutch Jones Education Sports Program, although Major League Baseball technically made that donation. But I had to remove it from my final count because, despite an MLB press piece labeling it support for a Buffalo youth program post-tragedy, a rep for the Bisons informed me that it wasn't 514-related at all. was a regular grant funded through MLB's Reviving Baseball in Inner Cities program. I ran into a similar situation with the Bills. The team had a press piece published on the second anniversary of the massacre about how the team continued to give back to Western New York 2 years after the shooting. Among the listed partnerships and programs was a three-year pledge to the Healthy Community Store Initiative, which works to address disparities in food access. But a representative from the Cornell Cooperative Extension of Erie County, which operates the program, told me the pledge was not created in response to the tragedy and instead came through a standard grant application process. So, a general takeaway on sports teams, leagues, and foundations. Some giving was direct and intentional, while some appeared more symbolic or tied to pre-existing efforts. That doesn't diminish the value of the contributions, but it does complicate the question of what was truly created in response to 514. My fourth and final category, GoFundMe. There were many pages created in response to 514, along with concerns about which campaigns were legitimate. I identified seven that I could verify drew significant contributions. One raised more than $11,000 for the Resource Council of Western New York to distribute food and other necessities to families impacted by the temporary closure of the Jefferson Avenue TOPS. Another raised more than $200,000 to support Feed Buffalo, a food pantry that closed last year. Four of the seven campaigns brought in five and six-figure totals that were ultimately forwarded to the only GoFundMe page I could find that raised millions, the Buffalo 514 Survivors Fund. 3 years ago, my colleague Emily Watkins interviewed Jeff Dion, executive director of the National Compassion Fund, on What's Next to better understand the process of collecting and distributing funds to victims and survivors after tragedies. I followed up with Mr. Dion to learn more about the fund's final total, obtain a more detailed distribution breakdown, and seek clarification on eligibility requirements after hearing accounts from some survivors who said they were unexpectedly denied compensation late in the process.
So I did see a report from the steering committee. It showed the final donation amount coming in at $6,452,355.32. Is that indeed the final amount?
Yes.
Okay, so there's the final total. Okay.
Yeah, that is the final total. And we distributed that amount to the penny. And that's why there were two people who got an odd amount of money that ended in 66 cents because, you know, we just had to make sure that every penny was spent.
And in the beginning, I understand there were also different categories for those who would be eligible for compensation. I believe there were four, depending on who had been impacted and how. Can you sort of go over those?
Sure. Generally, we look at people who were present and whether they were the legal heirs of someone who was killed, whether they were someone who suffered a physical injury, or whether they were someone who was present and experienced psychological trauma. Now, the steering committee gets to define and finalize those categories. And what the steering committee did was they divided up the injury category into those who were injured by gunfire and another category for those who suffered some other type of injury that had outpatient treatment. You know, someone could be injured, you know, running for their life from a gunman or so. And any injury arising out of that event that wasn't actually being hit by with a bullet or shrapnel. And then they also made the decision that they would recognize in a fifth category, TOPS employees who were not present at the time because they lost their store for a month and this happened. And so they wanted to recognize those as well. And so based on those proposed categories, the steering committee published a draft protocol.
Do you have a count of how many people received compensation from each category?
Yes. So there were 10 applicants in the deceased category because there were 10 people killed. There were three approved applications in category B, which was injury by gunfire. Category C, which was other injury with outpatient treatment, there was just one person. For psychological trauma, there were 107 people. And for TOPS employees who were not present, that was 48 people. So there were 169 validated applicants. But we had over 400 applications because the way the steering committee drew those lines, they, you know, they drew a circle around the store and the parking lot, and that people who were inside that circle were going to be covered and eligible for direct payments. People outside the circle were not. And that's the balancing act that a steering committee has to make. They want to make sure that the circle is wide enough to encompass all of the people that were directly impacted, but not so broad that it dissipates the amount of significant help that you're going to be able to give to people. So we had probably about 200 people who applied who were not validated because they weren't eligible. Either the police said they weren't there or they didn't meet, you know, other criteria. So that was difficult too, because I think we worked with a lot of community groups in helping people with their applications, but I think there was one group that didn't want to be the ones to tell people you're not eligible, you know, even though they clearly were not because they weren't present, but they said, well, just go ahead and submit an application anyway. And so then we had like 200 extra applications that we had to deal with and the police had to look at and validate. That, you know, didn't meet the criteria in the protocol.
And that's where things get complicated. Even when so many measures are taken to handle such a critical process, one where every penny must not only be accounted for, but legitimized, is it possible that, in an effort to make sure no one filing a false claim receives compensation meant for victims and survivors, some applicants who were impacted according to the fund's guidelines can still slip through the cracks? That's what Dolores Jackson says happened to her. Dolores is a 65-year-old Eastside native who enjoyed gardening, preparing Sunday dinners for her family, helping care for seniors in the neighborhood. Life as she knew it would change, all because she decided to go to the grocery store one Saturday afternoon. She unknowingly parked right next to a white nationalist from the town of Conklin, and while she was shopping, she suddenly heard gunfire. She hid in a freezer. When it was finally safe to evacuate, she sustained injuries running for her life. She later discovered her car had been struck by gunfire in the parking lot. Dolores said she immediately left the scene, too shell-shocked to give a police statement. But she said federal agents found her, arriving at her doorstep and identifying her as a witness. Local organizations and law firms also found her. She began receiving notices by mail identifying her as a survivor of the mass shooting who might be eligible for compensation. Dolores wasn't seeking a payout from the tragedy, but as her mobility became limited, her medical expenses mounted, and her car needed repairs, the assistance became necessary. She put in a claim through the Buffalo 514 Survivors Fund, having sustained both physical injuries and psychological trauma. But applicants could only apply to be in one category, so she applied for the latter. She was also encouraged to apply for state assistance. Remember the person I told you about who filed a claim through the Office of Victim Services and received only $250? That was her. She was awarded the maximum amount of $500 allowed under state law, but ultimately received only half of that to help replace her car's gas line. As for her claim with the Survivors Fund, well, I'll let her tell her story, beginning with the day she'll never forget, even though she wishes she could.
Well, all that I can remember, it was a day that I don't want to remember. And then I can tell you it was very chaotic. Me having been in, like, you know, have had hazmat training and, like, defensive training in my career, I was able to, you know, like mediate for myself. It wasn't anybody given any instructions until most folks had gotten to the outside where we were told to sit on the ground, when I thought that was not so nice either. Okay, because some of us was injured, as I was. And I think I fell over something when I came out of the store. So I'm not sure what it is that I fell over, but I ended up with two busted ankles. So moving forward, I was totally impacted. And my car was damaged on the property, from being on the property. So it's just been a journey, you know, with the psychological impact is ongoing. And just the loss of a community. And until someone takes the lead, not someone, each individual, and work cooperatively together to try to bring this community back to vital status for the people that live here. Yes.
Yes, it's very necessary. So, as you just said, you were in the store that day, your car got damaged, you were parked next to the individual, and your car got hit by a gunfire.
I was.
And so you, according to the National Compassion Fund standards, according to a lot of standards of these different organizations, were eligible for financial compensation based on physical and, you know, traumatic injuries that you endured. But what did you actually receive?
To date that I know, I could tell you I got $250 that I can account for. I was supposed to receive a payment through the National Compassionate Fund, but unfortunately, I received an email at the ninth hour that the money was to be deposited into a Zelle account that I had to open. And I was told maybe 3 days before the payment was supposed to go down in an email that I wasn't entitled and I didn't meet the criteria of the Compassionate Fund.
So 3 days before. So up until that point, they had you open a Zelle account. They communicated with you as though you had been verified and you would be receiving funds.
Right. And I have been interviewed by been interviewed by a detective. In fact, he was a retired a detective who came back to assist in the heavy caseload of folks that needed to be interviewed and talked to and so on and so forth. And then there was a while later during the journey and during the application process of the Compassionate Fund, we were being vetted by FBI and, you know, special services, you know, to see if we in fact were criteria qualified to receive. And I fulfill every criteria. I didn't know what I was supposed to get, and I don't know what happened to all of those resources that came into the community. Man, I can tell you, I didn't receive what I would call substantial resources to put me back to my space that I had enjoyed before the tragedy.
Dolores showed me the email she received in October of 2022 from the Buffalo 514 Survivors Fund, notifying her that she was ineligible for compensation because law enforcement couldn't verify her presence in the store or its parking lot on May 14th at the time of the shooting. Grady Lewis has a similar, yet slightly more complex story. Like Dolores, he's also an Eastside native. On May 19th, he technically turned 55 years old. He says technically, because as he told me, he feels he lost a birthday in 2022. Before May of that year, he had a simple life, a life he lived on his own terms.
I was free, actually. Like I said, I collect bottles.
in cans on my own. Didn't really want for much, pretty much happy-go-lucky.
As one would expect, that changed after the racist attack on Jefferson Avenue. But his trauma begins with memories of the day before, May 13th. If Grady Lewis' name sounds familiar, it may be because his story's been told by national and local news outlets. He had an hours-long conversation with the man who would carry out the mass shooting a day before it actually happened, with no way of knowing who he was, what hate-driven ideologies fueled him, or what he would do the next day. Then, Grady witnessed the mass shooting from the parking lot. He processed what he saw as best as he could, for as long as he could.
I kind of left my body, and the little bit of coof my mother gave me, I just floated off of that for like a year and a half.
Grady was traumatized once in the parking lot that day. He was traumatized again when, after being questioned by detectives and having his story told on the world stage, he too was told that his presence couldn't be verified by law enforcement. So I asked the head of the National Compassion Fund if he could explain how someone who says they followed the protocols, down to being vetted by federal agents, could still be found ineligible for compensation.
So do you think that part of it kind of made the process a bit messy, for lack of a better term, you know, sending out those applications, even out of suspicion that the person may not have been able to be validated or was present or eligible for compensation? Because it also makes me think of something similar. I had a conversation with a couple of individuals who said that they were there. One individual said he was in the parking lot. A woman said she was actually in the store in the freezer while it was going on. They were both told to set up Zelle accounts, but in around like October, they were both told that they were ineligible because law enforcement couldn't verify them. I guess my question is, you know, do you think there should have been something done differently to not make people believe that they may have been eligible for compensation, knowing that, you know, they weren't?
Well, what we do know is that the best practices for law enforcement, the Police Executive Research Foundation put out a report for responding to mass violence. And one of the best practices that they recommend is to make sure you have a census of everybody who was at the scene that you get a statement from. And so you develop a victim list. Subsequent to the Patop shooting, there was a series of mass shootings in Lewiston, Maine, where a gunman shot up a bowling alley and then went to a restaurant and shot that up. And there, law enforcement took everybody who was present. They put them on a bus. They brought them all to the armory where they got a statement from all of them and got their names. So they had a list of who was there. And so that worked really well, as opposed to, you know, in Buffalo, where we said we had a name and, you know, the police detectives were looking through sheets and trying to find stuff and trying to talk to people. But we do know that there were people who submitted applications fraudulently under assumed identities who were not there. And so we feel we have to do this to safeguard the donors who said they wanted to give to victims, to protect the victims. Because if we give a dollar to someone who wasn't there and shouldn't have it, that's a dollar we're taking away from someone who was there. And we went through, you know, especially because it was difficult for law enforcement, particularly people in the parking lot, but people in the store, we were able to validate everybody in the store because we went through, you know, we would submit multiple requests to TOPS, to their security division, who would look at the security camera footage. And we'd have to ask people, who were you with? What were you wearing? So they could spot them on the footage. And it's been 4 years, but I'm pretty sure that we were successful in validating everybody who was in the store.
Okay, so I did want to ask, and maybe this is a question for our local law enforcement and not for you, but do you know, what you did just kind of explain to me, the standards by which law enforcement were going to verify individuals. But I am wondering, the two individuals that I spoke to, they did say they were on that victims list and still receive correspondence even from the FBI, letting them know about when the trial will be with the shooter, Peyton Gendron, that, you know, they've been contacted without, you know, seeking out like law enforcement or funds or anything, but they were, you know, identified. But they say that through the National Compassion Fund, law enforcement couldn't verify them. Do you know how or why that would have happened?
Well, sure. They, because and for victim witness notification, they don't have any need to validate. If you say, I was there and I'm a victim and I want to be notified about this, they'll put you on that list. And so to be able to be notified of things. But for us, you know, I've done 32 of these, and, you know, I think the validation, particularly in a very public place like this, is very tricky. If it's at a school or a workplace where people have clocked in or they've taken attendance for kids, and you have a much stronger, easier way to identify who was there. But we have seen wherever we have tried to offer alternatives for validation, we've run into fraudulent attempts to get money. And we weren't involved in the Boston Marathon bombing fund, but there were, I think, four people who went to prison for falsely submitting medical records and, you know, claiming injuries and getting like $250,000 from the Boston One Fund when, you know, they weren't even there. And so for us to be transparent and a trusted source, we've got to strike that balance and make sure that we can validate someone's presence.
Post-crisis recovery is complex. Cities, much less individuals, are seldom prepared to manage life after a large-scale tragedy. Decisions have to be made, and money has to move quickly. There's a lot of coordination that has to happen within a short time span. But that coordination doesn't happen easily, as we've seen. Getting everyone on the same page to determine things like who qualifies as a victim or a survivor and how to validate that is an essential but difficult task. It becomes especially difficult when it comes to managing millions of dollars. It's not a complication that was only visible within the Buffalo 514 Survivors Fund. It was seen within the management of organizations and facilities that were established or received funding to assist the impacted community. What makes it so difficult to account for the dollars and cents poured out in the name of recovery are two things. One, there is no single ledger. The public has to rely on press releases, news conferences, reports from steering committees, archive fundraisers, budget allocations, and sheer memory. As time progresses and terms change, even these become harder to rely on. The second difficulty arises from the term itself, recovery. What does it mean in this context? How did a racially motivated mass shooting evolve from immediate needs, grief counseling, funeral expenses, and immediate food access, to planning for years-long revitalization projects for an entire community? And as revitalization plans stretch years into the future, some residents are left asking a difficult question. What exactly is there to show right now for the tens of millions announced in the name of recovery? Perhaps most importantly, who gets to define recovery, and how does it align with residents and survivors who, 4 years later, are still trying to recover themselves? How do these households shape decisions about where the money goes and who should be handling it? In this episode, we've taken a look at the scale of generosity that's grown annually since 2022. We've analyzed some big names behind big gifts. We've seen transparency range from donor to donor. We've learned how pre-existing initiatives and generous contributions can be repurposed to fit the narrative of helping a community devastated by an act of terror. We've observed how accounting for every person entitled to funds and resources can be as daunting a task as accounting for every dollar that was given in the first place. We've seen, for the most part, where the money came from, but we still don't have much of an account of where it's gone, or where it hasn't gone for that matter. That's what we'll analyze in the next episode of Where Did the Money Go? A What's Next special from BTPM NPR. I'm Ijaz Jasil. Thank you for listening.
Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.